Well, hello everyone. Recently, Hulk Hogan died, and a lot of people have been asking me, because I'm well known as a pro wrestling fan, to record something about this. I have to be honest, I haven't really had time to prepare this. I haven't looked at any notes or old videos or things, so I'm going to go off the top of my head. But I did think it was necessary to make something. Maybe people who aren't into pro wrestling won't get this, but if you were into pro wrestling as a kid, it was a major part of your childhood and something that never really leaves you. And even beyond that, as I've talked about extensively, it gives you weird insights into the world of politics and many other walks of life once you understand things like crowd psychology, how to work an angle, booking and storylines and so on and so forth. Now, Hulk Hogan is perhaps single-handedly responsible, or he's one of the chief people responsible, along with Vince McMahon, for basically anybody my age or younger being a pro wrestling fan at all. Before that time, pro wrestling was a fairly big deal in America with the NWA, but it was the domain, really, of old-fashioned sports fans. You can imagine like old dudes going along to some arena in Oklahoma somewhere, to watch a bit of the wrestling. There's a bit of a stereotype about that, but it is basically true that the presentation of pro wrestling before the 80s boom there was presented more like kind of athletics, more like amateur wrestling in a way. It was Dory Funk Jr. versus Jack Briscoe. Now, I love that stuff as well. But the thing that brought everybody to the dance was Hulk Hogan. Now, when I was a kid, I was actually a heel fan. That means I supported the villains. Those of you who know me won't be that surprised. I have a contrarian nature. So all of my favourites were heels. I liked Ted DiBiase, he was my favourite, the Million Dollar Man, Mr. Perfect, Ravishing Rick Rude. I just loved the heels. I always thought the heels were... they seem like the better wrestlers, you know, to my kind of child's view, turned out rightly. Actually, in actuality, they are better technicians. But because of that, when I was a kid, I actually hated Hulk Hogan. When I was a little mark, believing all of the storylines, I always felt that Hulk Hogan, you know, got away with murder. He actually got away with murder. And I'd be thinking, like, Jesse Ventura, you're making great points there on commentary, or Bobby the Brain Heenan. They were always brought up really good points that President Jack Tunney was biased for Hogan, that Hogan got away with things that would have DQ'd everyone else, or using a steel chair, or raking the back, or like, Hogan was a bastard, really. So I kind of grew up disliking Hogan because I was always cheering for the heels. And of course, Hogan always came out with his fist raised, the pose down, the ear cup to the crowd, and the end of the Coliseum home videotape was always, yet again, Hogan winning, which kind of always left me a bit sore because I was cheering for the other guy 9 times out of 10. Subsequently, I kind of have learned over the many years to love Hulk Hogan, which is a little bit ironic because once you get online, a lot of the smart fans went in the other direction. They actually dislike Hulk Hogan because a lot of the other wrestlers, always accuse Hogan of being a liar, or, you know, it doesn't work for me, brother, and all that sort of stuff. Because backstage, he was a consummate politician. You know, he was known for not doing, not putting people over, not doing jobs. You know, he had creative control in WCW. You've heard all these stories a million times. And because of that, I think it led, especially because the online wrestling scene really was starting to burgeon in the late 90s, early 2000s. There was guys like Scott Keith and people like that. I actually talked to Scott Keith once upon a time. But because it was kind of during that era and a lot of people were finding out like dirt for the first time, backstage stuff, Hogan, I think, amongst like the online fans got a bit of a bad reputation, and you know they criticised him as a lazy worker and all this sort of stuff as well. That is not really true. Hulk Hogan was exceptionally talented, I think. You've got to remember, he was a very big guy. I can't remember his exact height, but he was over 6'5". At his peak, maybe even a 6'8", something like that. Huge guy. And you go back and watch some of those matches, and he's basically selling his ass off in 90% of the time, extracting sympathy from the crowd. You know, he takes pretty much every move that the heel can throw at him. And then, you know, in the last 2 minutes or so of the match, the finger pops up, he makes the big comeback, puffs out his cheeks, you know, big boot, leg drop, and it's over. But for the most of the match, he's actually giving the heel quite a lot of time to, you know, generate heat, as it were. Hulk Hogan was an exceptional talent. He had, obviously, that it factor that is difficult to put into words. What I'm going to do, I think, in this video, is actually just run through some of the bits of his career. You know, more casual fans may not know some of this sort of stuff. You can basically break Hogan's career down into distinct phases. I would say there's the very early Hogan, which I'll talk about in a second. There's the AWA Hogan, and the Hogan who was wrestling in New Japan during that same period in the early 80s there. There is the Hulkamania main 80s Hogan that everybody knows and loves, the rock and roll era, the boom Hogan of the mid to late 80s, early 90s. Then there is he goes over to WCW, and then there's the NWO Hollywood Hogan that a lot of people still also remember. Phenomenal heel run there during the Monday Night Wars, actually triggered the Monday Night Wars. And then there's, I guess you'd call it, the late Hogan. He has this weird little run as Mr. America or something. And he actually had several comebacks in WWE and even won the title again, I seem to recall, in the mid-2000s. I seem to remember he beat Chris Jericho. Somebody will have to... I'm a bit hazy on some of the details. And like I said, I've done no prep, so all of this is going on memory with zero prep. But those are the distinct phases. And if you go right back, and I might as well just go through them in order. He actually started out his career as a heel. He was working, in fact, his earliest run that you can catch on tape is in 1979 in the WWF, or the WWWF as it was then. His very first match at Madison Square Garden is against Ted DiBiase. Ted DiBiase then, a kind of white meat babyface, Hogan presented as this kind of monster heel in a gold cape, as he was. And that run is pretty interesting if you watch it. I've watched most of those, most of that run on tape is, you know, the Philly Spectrum stuff, the stuff at Madison Square Garden. He has a feud, believe it or not, with Andre the Giant during that time. And it's kind of funny because one of them, later on, he has a much more famous feud with Andre and it culminates in the huge match at WrestleMania 3. And one of the huge talking points in that is that, you know, Andre the Giant had never been body slammed. He'd never been slammed. And that was like, you know, one of the big talking points. Actually, in that match in 1980 that Hogan has with Andre, he slams him about two or three times. Andre wins because he is the big special attraction babyface. Hogan is the heel. But it's just quite funny. That was actually quite a big feud, that Andre-Hogan feud in 1980. They ran a show in a special arena, Shea Stadium. And I believe the Hogan match was in that Shea Stadium show. It was actually a pretty big gate for the time. Anyway, Hogan leaves WWF. I believe one of the reasons for him leaving is that he was offered the chance to be in Rocky III, and Vince McMahon Sr. was very old school, and he was like, oh, no, you know, he's grumbling. He didn't want to give him the time. So he basically left WWF, and he went on several tours of New Japan. You can watch some of those matches too. It's one of those kind of talking points that Hogan could actually wrestle, and he's got matches with Inoki and various other people where he's doing like drop toe holds and suplexes and things like that. And you're like, wow, you know, Hogan could do a drop kick and things like this. It's true. Hogan was capable of doing all of that. But then like the typical old fashioned point was to say, well, okay, that means he was just phoning it in later on. That means that, you know, he was just being lazy later on. That's not actually true. What happened is that Hogan pared down his moveset and kept those things that were effective and lost those things that didn't make sense. Okay? If you're a 6'8" guy going up against, any other wrestler, let's say it's Hulk Hogan versus Ted DiBiase, right? Now, Ted DiBiase, when we were watching as kids, you didn't think of him as a big guy. But Ted DiBiase is actually a huge guy. He was like 6'3", you know, 260-270 pounds. In any other walk of life, this is a huge man, okay? But up against Hulk Hogan, Hogan is massive, right? So in that sort of context, to have Hogan running around doing like drop toe holds and, back suplexes and things would have looked a bit silly, right? It was kind of Hogan's job to try to make his opponents look good as well, and to make him to make it look like, so it depends on the kind of matchup, but if it's Hogan versus any normal wrestler, the size advantage has to be emphasized. So it's actually just Hogan was working smart. He was working smarter, not harder. And this is one of those things that took a very long time, I think, for the online community to understand that, like, not every wrestler, you know, has to work like Chris Benoit or Dean Malenko or something like this, or Eddie Guerrero. These were kind of like workhorse guys when I first got online back in the late 90s. Actually, a lot of pro wrestling is, how do you work the crowd? How do you get more from less? And Hogan, if you watch him, was an absolute master at doing all of those little things to maximize that crowd reaction. Anyway, probably his first really, really big run, if you don't count the WWF one, the heel run that I mentioned, is when he went to Vern Gagne's promotion, AWA. And in the AWA, the champion was an old guy, Nick Bockwinkel. As a sideline, Nick Bockwinkel was a phenomenal wrestler, probably one of the best wrestlers of all time. He could do everything, Nick Bockwinkel. But by the early 80s, by 1982, 1983, he'd been a champion for a very long time there, and he was getting old as well. And it was probably time for him to pass the torch. And I've watched a lot of that back in the day. We used to do DVD trading, and I've got a ton. I've still got hundreds, thousands even, of wrestling DVDs here, including all of the best matches of the AWA, from various tape traders over the years. And one of the things I'll say is that if you haven't watched some of that stuff, Hogan's reactions in AWA are white hot electric. I mean, he's not just hot. He is, I mean, there's heat and then there's kind of 100% electricity heat, you know, where you can kind of feel the hairs on the back of your hand stand up. And Hogan in AWA elicited those sorts of reactions. He also had a number of pretty decent matches. I mean, the Nick Bockwinkel matches are the thing everybody talks about is that they did this supercard, and Vern Gagne, being old school and not with the times and so on, did a kind of fuck finish, what they call a fuck finish, where the crowd thought Hogan had won the AWA world title, but the referee reversed the decision. So still the world champion is Nick Bockwinkel. And basically like that killed a lot of Hogan's momentum. And it also basically, you know, told everybody, listen, Vern Gagne just doesn't know what he's doing at this time, you know. But anyway, some of Hogan's other matches in AWA are pretty worth tracking down. I seem to remember there was this big fat guy called Jerry Blackwell, who was pretty agile for a big man like that. I seem to remember the Hogan-Jerry Blackwell matches were decent. There's a few other decent matches from the AWA run. He also has a few with Jesse Ventura, who is somebody who would harbour a lifelong mutual animosity. Like, Hogan and Ventura actually hated each other, which is possibly why Ventura's heel commentary on Hogan matches was so good, because he genuinely hated the guy, and vice versa. But anyway, then we get the big money, the historic move of Hogan going into the WWF. And what's really interesting is that you can go right back and see Hogan's first television appearance on Championship Wrestling. I think it's like right at the beginning, like January 1984, straight in. And they have him team. It's like Bob Backlund versus whoever and a mystery partner. And the mystery partner is Hulk Hogan, okay? And one of the amazing things is that on commentary, they actually recognize Hulk Hogan from his previous, because remember, it'd only been 2 or 3 years ago. And they were like, oh, Hulk Hogan, wasn't he a bad guy? Oh, he's changed his ways. That's really funny to go back and look, because it just in a couple of weeks after that is when Hogan defeats the Iron Sheik and starts that mammoth first WWF title run. Also kind of tragic, if you go back and watch that match, is that, of course, the guy who was absolutely sidelined, whose career was kind of stopped dead by Hogan coming in, was Bob Backlund. And of course, Vince has Hogan come in as Backlund's partner. And within, I don't know, 4, 5, 6 months, Backlund is so much yesterday's guy. He is so much history. He's so kind of forgotten as ancient history, even. It's unreal. So, but Backlund probably was a little bit hard done by there, and how he was just kind of like shunted aside by the juggernaut of Hogan coming in. But anyway, once this run starts, when he defeats the Iron Sheik and becomes champion in 1984, if you haven't gone back and watched, like what fans do now a lot of the time, is they'll go back and they'll watch the WrestleManias, and they'll watch the SummerSlams and Royal Rumbles. They'll watch like the big pay-per-views, and they won't bother with anything else. Okay, what you really need to do is track down the house shows: Madison Square Garden, Philly Spectrum, Boston Garden. Sometimes they did the ones up in Toronto. What's the name of that Toronto stadium? Anyway, they did the Maple Leaf Gardens. You know, those were the big ones that they used to do. Sometimes they do LA as well when they broke that market. And they also started working places like Cow Palace in San Francisco, and Chicago after AWA was kind of dying as well. So, I mean, there are lots of big towns that Hogan worked, but those were the big ones: Madison Square Garden, Philly Spectrum, Boston Garden, Maple Leaf, and sometimes they'd run the Cap Center as well in Landover, the Cap Center. If you can track down Hogan's title defenses in that run, he has got some phenomenal matches in there. There's matches against like Bob Orton Jr., Terry Funk, Paul Orndorff. I mean, the Paul Orndorff matches are amazing if you go back and watch them. When I say they're amazing, they're gritty. They're bloody. He often like does blade jobs in those matches. They're intense. They're really fierce. And some of those workers, Bob Orton Jr., Terry Funk, and Paul Orndorff, were phenomenal workers back in the day. Some of the Piper matches are worth tracking down as well. These are legendary workers, all of them. And Hogan had very, very good runs in all of these house shows with him. And one of the things that I think is a little bit tragic is that fans only remember the big moments. They only remember like Andre the Giant at WrestleMania 3, or Macho Man Randy Savage, or Ultimate Warrior. They forget about all of these other matches that he had. The way Hogan was booked was really a little bit like, do you remember the old like Adam West 60s Batman, where there's just like an endless conveyor belt of villains coming through? oh, this week it's the Joker, this week it's the Penguin, this week it's Catwoman, and so on. Hogan's very much booked like that in the 80s run, so it's like, this week it's Kamala, next week it's, you know, the Ugandan Giant, next week it's Killer Khan, now it's King Kong Bundy, etc. So there is this kind of conveyor belt effect, which was basically a holdover of the way Vince McMahon Sr. used to book all of those. There's kind of a little weird disconnect there between what's happening on TV and what's happening on that old house show circuit. Some of those shows are very much worth tracking down, or at least the highlights, the good matches, are worth tracking down. And often, if I feel like watching wrestling these days, I usually stick on a house show. Like, oh, you know, Boston Gardens from 1986. Oh, let's see what's on this card, you know. That's often what I do. Word of warning, they usually stuck a 20-minute jobber match right at the front. Right at the start of that, it'll be like, Paul Roma versus, you know, Brooklyn Brawler, 20 minutes. You know, it'd be something like that. So just a word of warning, they often like to put those cooler matches right at the start. But apart from that, there's a lot of good stuff on those shows. And Hogan is surprisingly intense, he's electric, and you can see, watching that stuff, why it was he was such a phenomenon. Okay, I mean, let's go into the combination of factors that made him such a big star, okay? I've talked about his work in the ring, his ability to work the crowd, generate sympathy, and sell for his opponent. These were all key things. But obviously he was phenomenal as a hype guy, as a promo, as somebody who just had some extra dimension he could draw on, okay? And if you watch the stuff at the time, especially in 84, 85, 86, it's like he's coming from another planet, right? It's like he's such a ball of, such a kind of phenomenon. It's amazing to watch. Another aspect of what made Hogan so big was that, in my opinion, the stretch of booking, the booking of Hulk Hogan as the champion, everybody talks about with Vince McMahon how, like, the Monday Night Wars and the Austin versus McMahon thing, his creative kind of peak, kind of the genius story that he had. I actually think that him and Pat Patterson, the booking from, I would say from about, from the start of the Hogan-Andre feud up until probably the blow-off of the Mega Powers exploding in WrestleMania 5. Arguably, you could extend it even till the Warrior match the following year in WrestleMania 6. That stretch of booking is absolutely phenomenal. Every single aspect of it is brilliant. Andre's heel turn, where he rips the you know, the Christian cross, you know, the necklace that Hogan is wearing, and the shock. You've got to remember, when Andre turned, he had been a babyface for 15 straight years, an undefeated babyface for 15 years, known the world over and loved by fans. And to watch Andre team up with the dastardly, villainous Bobby the Brain Heenan, it was a shock to people. It was an absolute shock. And to see him turn on Hogan, you know, forget about it. So this is why WrestleMania 3 was a record gate and continues to be talked of as one of the great matches, one of the great angles, feuds of all time. The match, if you watch it, is nothing really. Andre could barely work at that time. You know, he was banged up. He could only string up. I mean, Andre is an underrated worker too, by the way. He was smart. Andre was a very smart worker. He knew how to present himself as a big man and work as a giant, you know. And he could work too. Go back and watch Hardy Race versus Andre the Giant, like a half an hour match. He could go, Andre. If you watch Andre in Japan, I always remember Andre the Giant versus Stan Hansen, or Andre the Giant versus Killer Khan. I mean, he could work. He could really go, especially when he was younger. But even old Andre could work very well. But unfortunately, that match they had at WrestleMania 3, not the best example, in my opinion. So what made that was the creative, was the packaging, was the storytelling, was the promos, was people like Bobby Heenan and Mean Gene Okerlund, you know, doing the interviews and things like that. The presentation was genius around Hogan. So, and the way Hogan loses the belt when Andre the Giant, Ted DiBiase has the Million Dollar Man has come in. He tries to buy the belt from Hogan. Hogan refuses to sell the belt to DiBiase. So DiBiase does a deal with Bobby the Brain Heenan to enlist the services of Andre, who then buddies up with DiBiase. Andre somehow defeats Hulk Hogan with a fast count from the referee, and then in one of the all-time legendary angles at a show that was called the Main Event. If you haven't seen it, track down that Main Event from February 1988, January, February 1988, so sometime around then, when Andre wins that belt, and it transpires that DiBiase has paid a doppelganger, a referee, to have plastic surgery to look like the Earl Hebner or Dave Hebner. I can't remember which way around it was. The evil twin ref angle. One of the all-time phenomenal things. And I believe that Main Event was an all-time TV record for a long time. That sets up a tournament at WrestleMania 4, which obviously then the big story is, well, Andre and Hogan, they end up meeting. And of course, in the final of the WrestleMania 4 tournament, Ted DiBiase faces Randy Savage, and that's how Savage becomes the champion. So Savage doesn't beat Hogan, he goes over in this tournament, okay? Then, Savage and Hogan, because Savage is now a babyface and not a heel, buddy up, and they form something called the Mega Powers, and feud with Andre and DiBiase, okay? The Mega Bucks, the Mega Powers versus the Mega Bucks. That was the story all across 1988. That was the story all across then. And it's just brilliant. It's just brilliant storytelling because they slow burn it. Savage's thing is always that he was jealous of anyone who got close to his wife, Miss Elizabeth. And Hogan is like putting her on his shoulder. Hogan is, you know, there's simmering tension, and you can just, it's done in little looks, and it's done in, you can see the tension emerging over the course of that year between Savage and Hogan. You can see Savage is just burning away underneath. And the way they slow burn this angle, literally for a year, from WrestleMania 4 all the way until WrestleMania 5, until the Mega Powers explode and we get this amazing match at WrestleMania 5, where Hogan wins the belt back, from Savage. That match is pretty good, by the way. But the whole year of booking there, and going all the way back to the Andre turn, that two-year block, for me, is some of the best pro wrestling storytelling of all time guaranteed. Okay. Now, as things progress in this run, if you ask me, Hogan does get a little bit formulaic. I think one of the issues is that he kept on like going away, doing movies and coming back. And a few times, I think like Vince and Hogan hadn't quite figured out that it wasn't 1986 anymore. And that times had moved on a little bit, or he was the luster was starting to go. And there's a few times I think you can see this. There's a couple of Royal Rumbles where Hogan wins. I think Royal Rumble 1991 stands out in my mind, where you think, like, did Hogan really need to win that one? Like, you know, he comes in fairly late. You know, okay, the crowd pops and all of that. But maybe we should have made a different star there, you know? There's another time. The era that really stands out for me is Royal Rumble 92, where clearly the crowd want to pop for Sid Justice, right? And Hogan is starting to get booed and the crowd is starting to turn a little bit. This is actually a reoccurring theme in Sid's career. The same thing happened later on when he was feuding with Shawn Michaels. The crowd wanted to cheer for Sid. He was a big guy. He was, you know, people love a badass. And in 1995, 96, frankly, most of the crowd thought Shawn Michaels was gay. Right, I mean, the reason that Shawn Michaels was being booed is because they saw him as being gay, right? And Sid was a badass, okay? But in 92, people had just had a little bit of enough of Hogan. Another really egregious one that people talk about is WrestleMania 9, when Yokozuna beats Bret Hart, and then for some reason Hogan comes out and then immediately beats Yokozuna in about a minute and becomes the champion again, only to lose it in King of the Ring with a dodgy cameraman. That's another one where it's like, come on. So really what had happened is that Hogan needed to move on, and he actually did go to WCW after that. There's a couple of years there where he just tries to recreate 1985-86 era again, only this time it's 1995. Some of that stuff is some of the worst stuff in Hogan's career. They, do you remember I said the Adam West Batman, you know, the villain of the week thing? When it's Hogan versus the Dungeon of Doom, and it's literally like Kamala, only Kamala in 1995, so he's old. You know, I think they even bring back King Kong Bundy, and I think they bring in Giant Haystacks, you know, the British wrestler. Oh, the Dungeon of Doom stuff is dog shit. It really is. I mean, there's another way of watching it. I mean, there used to be a website back in the day called Wrestle Crap, and that was kind of famous for making fun of Dungeon of Doom. There's another way of watching this kind of stuff, ironically. I kind of love that stuff as well, to be honest. You know, King Curtis Ikea doing crazy promos, and Kevin Sullivan and all of that. But then we get the huge heel turn in WCW, and you know, the moment where he comes out with the Outsiders and calls the fans to throw trash in the ring. And really the NWO, especially at the start, especially in 96, 97 sort of era, that was a white hot angle. It really did get over huge. And it kind of gave Hogan a real shot in the arm. It kind of gave him, probably added another 6-7 years to his career at the top there, because that heel turn was so shocking and it was so well done. One of the amazing things, if you go back and watch WCW Hollywood Hogan, is the way he works. I mean, he works like a kind of a Memphis heel, right? He's kind of like a really kind of stooging, Jerry Lawler-ish, you know, sniveling chicken shit heel, and it's kind of really funny. Like he's raking the back. He's so like, the no move is too cheap. I actually really appreciate some of Hogan's heel work, because it's so, it's like real Carney Memphis style, and I kind of dig it, you know. You know, he's channeling his hero superstar Billy Graham a little bit with some of that stuff, but you can tell, like, this is like, you know, I'd imagine like Freddie Blassie would have worked like that in the 50s or something like that. You know, he's just there's a level of desperation and viciousness and cowardice to Hogan's heel work that you have to appreciate. Now, obviously, as everybody knows, that kind of falls off the rails with creative control and things. And by about 1999, 2000, there's a lot of crap WCW stuff as well, and a lot of feuds that should have been good that ended up not being that good. There's a period in 99, 2000 where it's like, you know, Ric Flair is still there and Bret Hart is there, but he's not that good. And there's just a lot of wasted opportunities in late WCW. And then we get to the very late Hogan era, where he has that final couple of runs in WWF. One of the biggest things that happens, of course, is his match with The Rock, where it's Hollywood Hogan versus The Rock. Hogan is brought in as a heel. The Rock is brought in as a babyface. And the crowd cannot help but cheer Hogan and boo The Rock, because the crowd love him that much. And that is when, basically, the heel Hogan had no choice but to go back to being a babyface at that time. That's a legendary match to watch. I remember watching it live with a tear in my eye. It was an amazing thing. So, Hogan, just a legend, an absolute legend. And the reason that basically anybody who loves pro wrestling got into it in the first place One of the things that you see in a lot of interviews and things like that is that people, a lot of the other workers, the ones who like Hogan are the ones who recognize that if he was on the gate, it would mean like almost doubling their pay sometimes. It'd be like an extra 50 to 100% on their pay packet. Because back in the day, workers were not paid a fixed salary. They were paid based on the gate, right? Well, if Hogan was on the gate, he could guarantee a sellout, or he could guarantee, you know, that many more fans, which would mean that many more tickets sold, which would mean a bumper payday for the boys. And I've never quite understood some of those workers that didn't really understand that Hogan, in order to maintain his aura, in order to maintain that what I'm talking about, that kind of record-breaking gate that I'm talking about from arena to arena, he needed to maintain his kind of undefeated, you know, his aura of being undefeatable, his aura of not being pinned. You know, to a certain extent, you can actually understand why it doesn't work for me, brother, okay? Especially in the 80s run, especially in the 80s. By the time you get to late WCW, arguably, you know, you can make arguments another way. Somebody started cutting down a tree here, so it's probably time for me to go. I just wanted to talk about Hulk Hogan a little bit and, you know, share some memories, give a potted history of the man. I mean, so many memories, so many great moments that he gave us. I mean, I barely even scratched the surface here. A little bit off the cuff, but yeah, let me know what you think. Let me know some of your favorite Hogan memories. You know, there's all kind of little fan things. Like, do you remember the time that he Arn Anderson beat him in 1995? I mean, that was 1996. That was an amazing moment. you know, great one for the fans. But you know, many other moments too. All right, rest in peace, Hulk Hogan. Pick up a course at the Academic Agency, and I'll see you all soon. If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the Academic Agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.